Thank you for joining us for Sermons on Demand from Friendship Grace Brethren Church. We provide these videos as a way to share the pulpit messages and teachings offered at Friendship Grace Brethren Church. If you find these videos a helpful resource, please drop us a note at info@friendshipgracebrethren.com. Now open your Bibles and get ready to dig into the Word of God. This morning we return to the Gospel of Luke. We're in the middle of chapter 9, and we're not going to get all the way through 9 this week, and next week we continue in part 2, Lord willing, of headed toward Jerusalem. Last week we worked through Jesus' instruction on following Him. How were you to live in following Jesus? Then Dr. Luke recorded that what has been called the Transfiguration, which is when the physical and spiritual worlds were both visible to the boys, Peter, James, and John. Peter, James, and John got to see Jesus in His divinity as well as in His humanity. I don't think this is as much a transfiguration as it is a revealing. Jesus didn't change. He just was revealed in what His divinity. And then Peter, James, and John got to see Jesus talking about the future events for Jesus, the going to the cross with Moses and Elijah. Two men that were kind of bookends, if you will, in Israel as they experienced the law from Moses, as they experienced the future from Elijah. The wonderful work of these two men combined. And that event then closes with the best James Earl Jones-like voice coming from heaven telling the boys to listen to Jesus. Listen to Him! By the way, with the passing of James Earl Jones this week, some have said that we should expect that voice to come out of heaven now, because God took him to heaven to use his voice. I think God could use His voice without taking Him to heaven, but we don't even know if He's in heaven. This morning we're going to walk through Jesus casting out a demon. The apostles couldn't do it. Jesus was talking about His pending death, and then an argument by some of the apostles about, well, who's the greatest in the kingdom? They still didn't get it. Dr. Luke has a great deal of information for us, so let's dig into the text, starting in chapter 9, verse 37. On the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, a great crowd met Him. Now, this verse is, again, short on specific information. It actually tells us a bunch, and I think it's very important what it tells us. Jesus and the boys had just been to the mountaintop. They had been to the mountain where Jesus was appearing to them in His divinity, in His Shekinah glory, if you will. Peter, James, and John saw Jesus in a way they have never seen before. They got to see, with the curtain peeled back to the spiritual world, Jesus standing there in His divinity. They got to see Moses and Elijah standing there in their apparent glorified state. This truly was a mountaintop experience for them. Jesus ended the experience by instructing the boys to not tell anyone about what they saw. Now, we all think we know the character and the attitude of Peter. Peter now has this great big secret that is fantastic, and he can't tell anybody. That's torture. That's by definition torture. Then Dr. Luke tells us, the next day, they're off the mountain, and a large crowd, they're back to reality, a large crowd is there. And as happens in the line of ministry, things change. As you're doing one thing, something else happens. We go through some special experiences, only to have to return to reality afterwards. Sometimes coming down from the mountaintop can cause a person to lose focus on the mission. In this verse, Dr. Luke is reflecting that their ongoing ministry doesn't occur on that mountaintop experience. We don't get to minister on the mountaintop. We minister in the valleys, in the gutters. We minister where everybody is. We actually face life and we face ministry apart from the mountaintop. We get to go to the mountaintop once in a while, and then we're back to reality. Dr. Luke also uses this verse to set the stage for what's coming. Dealing with crowds and the pressure of dealing with so many pressing issues, all coming upon the disciples at one time. Most of the disciples, all they had to worry about day to day was, were they going to get enough fish to get enough money to feed their family that day? They didn't have everybody else's issues to deal with. Sure, Peter had a mother-in-law who was sick, and he had to deal with those things, but we all have that, right? But in ministry, you have all the pressure of everybody else's issues coming in. Peter, James, and John needed to be prepared for what it was going to be like when Jesus was gone and they were left holding the bag, leading the church. Behold, a man from the crowd cried out, "Teacher, I beg you, look at my son, for he is my only child." And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth and shatters him and will hardly leave him. A father approaches Jesus, begging for Jesus to cast out a demon. The demon causes the boy to foam at the mouth and go into convulsions, and the father says the demon shatters the boy. Here's a case where you want to look at what those words really mean. You know, what does he mean by shatter? It seems kind of odd, right? The first time I read this week, I had just got done reviewing the lesson from Sunday school. Well, shatter stands out. Let's spend a little bit of time figuring out what that word really, what's really being said here. It's the Greek word syntribon, which is used to speak only of destructive demonic forces. From that, I understand that demon was causing the boy actual physical harm. Imagine what it's like when you get thrown down to the ground and you're in a grand mal seizure and you're flopping around and hitting rocks and stuff. He was causing physical damage to the boy. I can't imagine the agony of a parent watching a child go through something like that. And everything that you try doesn't work. I can't imagine the agony of that. But that's where this man was. And he saw Jesus and he heard about Jesus' miraculous works. And so he came to Jesus and said, "I beg you, this is my only son. Look what's happening to him. Help me." Verse 40, "And I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." Ruh-roh. He even went as far as asking or begging the apostles to cast out the demon. Remember, they'd been given the power over the spiritual world and the physical world. Jesus had sent them out. Now, whether or not this event happened while they were sent out, or maybe it's the nine that were left while Peter, James, and John went to the mountaintop, we don't know. We don't know when his interaction with the apostles happened. It doesn't really matter. How frustrating it had to be for the dad. How frustrating it had to be for the apostles. You know, they came back from their ministry of the 12 going out, you know, on a high. Look at all the things we did. Peter, James, and John just came back from the mountaintop with Jesus. Look what we saw. And then Dad comes up and says, "Look, they tried and they couldn't do it. They failed. And my son is still the way he was." Jesus answered, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." There's two sentences there. I have to admit that I've always thought that the response from Jesus was kind of odd. Here's a dad in agony over the kid who is having constant grand mal seizures and nothing can be done to help him. He went to the apostles and they couldn't help. And Jesus' answer is, "Oh, foolish and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you and bear with you?" I always thought that was odd. And again, in keeping with what Jay Warner is teaching us, why is it like it is? Why does Jesus say what he says? The response has always frustrated me until I really looked at what was happening and to whom Jesus was responding. Some New Testament scholars believe that it was the 9 apostles who were left who attempted and couldn't. And there's some kind of rationality there. We didn't get to go to the mountain with Jesus. We're left here doing the daily work. And they just didn't do it well. They believe that Jesus was speaking to them in this response. I don't think that text tells us that it was during the transfiguration that the man attempted to have the apostles cast out. It would seem more likely to me anyway that it was when the 12 were sent out on their ministry teams. Also, since Jesus castigates the entire generation, I think it's more than just the 9. I think it's the 12. I think it's all the Pharisees and the Sadducees and everybody around. I think it's everybody in Israel that isn't getting it. The entire population, each of these people groups, has varying degrees of the lack of faith. The father probably had the most faith of all of them. The apostles couldn't cast out the demon, even after Jesus gave them the authority to. The Pharisees thought Jesus was an agent of Satan. The majority of Israel's population failed to see Jesus in the position he held, creator, sustainer of the universe, both the physical and the spiritual worlds. Some scholars hold that Jesus allowed the pressure of the moment of his impending death to get to him, and so he lashed out at the boy's father. That doesn't seem logical. That doesn't seem likely. That's not keeping in character with Jesus. So I completely reject that idea. Jesus never let the pressure of his situation control his actions or his speech. I think Jesus is using this occasion to point out that in general, not everyone, but in general, Israel was not living by faith, not trusting God, and didn't trust Jesus as the Messiah. Despite the fact that Jesus had completed all of those messianic miracles, despite the fact that Jesus was teaching kingdom theology, the majority of the folks didn't get it. They didn't accept it. He's nearing the end of his earthly ministry, yet there's a general rejection of the kingdom theology and practice that he'd been teaching. Perhaps the greatest failure was from the apostles, who couldn't even cast out the demon. They'd been given power to, they have done it before, but they didn't in this case. While he was coming, the demon threw him to the ground and convulsed him. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. There's an awful lot of information there. Jesus told the dad to bring the boy to him, and as the dad was bringing the son, the demon threw the boy into convulsions, throwing him onto the ground. If you've never seen a person in a grand mal seizure, the imagery of this is not as real. If you've seen a person in a grand mal seizure and tried to aid them, this should scare the pants off of you. Because there is almost nothing short of giving a serious injection can you do to stop a grand mal when it's happening. All you can do is get something between their teeth so they don't hurt themselves and keep them from banging around and flopping like a chicken. It's scary, it's painful, and given the word shattered that we saw before, it was destructive to the boy. That's why Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy because of the destruction caused by the seizures. Thrashing about on the ground, injuring the boy, the demon was really hurting him. And that's a frightening sight to see a full body grand mal seizure. I have to imagine that a demon-induced seizure is even worse. Jesus rebuked the demon and gave the boy back to his father after healing him. Rebuke is the Greek word epitemeson. It's an interesting word. while rebuke is a good translation of the word, it doesn't really capture the full sense in English of the word. There's a sense of command with a threat. You get out of the boy or else kind of deal. We've previously seen the demons were not wanting to be cast into the abyss, eternal punishment right then. I suspect that this demon also was afraid of that. The cost of continuing to cause this boy such harm was going to be greater than leaving the boy. When I was a detective in the intelligence section, I worked for an old school lieutenant who had a sign over his door that read, "Crime will not decrease until becoming a criminal is significantly more dangerous than being a victim." Crime won't decrease until being a criminal is more dangerous than being a victim. That's exactly what Jesus was saying to this demon. You continue to do this, it's going to be way more dangerous than you're getting out of it. You're going to pay for this. That's what is contained in that word rebuke. He rebuked him with a threat. And I think the demon understood. Look what the crowd does. "And all were astonished at the majesty of God. While they were all marveling at everything he was doing, Jesus said to his disciples," and again, here we have some separation of verses that's not great for us. This verse is clear that the people who divided the text into verses and chapters didn't do it properly everywhere. This verse is clearly composed of the end of one paragraph and the beginning of another. So let's focus on the beginning of the verse. "And all were astonished at the majesty of God." Jesus cast out the demon by threatening it, and as a result, the people were astonished. The Greek word for astonished is ekplasuntu. The word has a sense of being overwhelmed or beyond comprehension. They couldn't comprehend in totality of the majesty of God. This was more than they could rationalize. This was a miracle, and so they couldn't, in naturalistic terms, fit it into their brain. I don't know what I just saw, kind of deal. And there's a real juxtaposition in this passage. On one side, Jesus talked about the lack of faith of people that the people of Israel demonstrated. On the other side, the amazement of God's power at the eviction of the demon. Both are true pictures of what's going on at the time in Israel, and I would argue here today. The refusal to trust God, but still amazed at the creative world, while not recognizing the Creator. Paul in Romans chapter 1 tells us that the unregenerate world refuses to see what's plain in front of them. The creative world screams for a creator. The complexity of our bodies requires somebody to design, but as Paul says, they refuse to see the truth that's right in front of them. In Mark's account of this incident, Jesus tells the disciples that the type of demon can only be cast out by prayer. I don't know why. Especially from the apostles who were given the authority by Jesus to do that. The apostles could not cast out the demon because they apparently didn't pray. This tells me that they didn't depend on God's power, but on their own abilities. If it was just the nine, it makes a little more sense because they weren't included in the going to the mountaintop experience, and so they were just going through the actions and not praying and not consulting God's power. If it was the 12, I would see this as being a situation where they had success, and what does success do? Makes us arrogant. I can do that. And they tried it on their own and not, again, asking for God's power. They didn't pray. And they didn't ask God to deal with this situation. And I think that contributed to Jesus calling the generation out for not having faith. Now let's move on to the second half of the verse. But while they were all marveling at everything he was doing, Jesus said to his disciples, Dr. Luke now begins to change the narrative a little. He changes topics. He begins a new paragraph. The scene is that the crowd is overwhelmed by the obvious work of God in their midst. So the crowd is overwhelmed. Jesus turns to his apostles and begins to talk about what's going to happen. They're all over here going, and Jesus says, look guys, this is not where it's at. Something else is going to happen. And he says to them, let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. Jesus grabs a hold of the scruff of their neck and says, look, let this sink into those thick skulls of yours. I'm about to be delivered into the hands of men. I'm about to die. So look at all that was going over here. Now pay attention to this. I'm about to die. I get what Jesus is doing. They had a hard time accepting what Jesus was about to do. I mean, let's try to rationalize it. Here he is. They see him as the Messiah. They see him as God. They saw him feed thousands of people from a Happy Meal. They saw him raise the dead. They saw him heal. They saw him cast out demons. He could do everything. What do you mean you're going to die? Those things seem like they're at opposite ends and are mutually exclusive. If I could do all of that, why would I die? That's what the apostles had to be thinking. How could he die? Look at verse 45. This verse is so important in our theological construct. But they didn't understand this saying, and it was concealed from them, so they might not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about this saying. Dr. Luke reveals to us why they couldn't understand it. It was concealed from them. Jesus is telling them the truth, and they can't comprehend it because their minds are not allowed to yet. They had no way to know because God was not allowing them to understand it. I also see in this verse three reasons that the apostles were hindered in receiving Jesus' message. They can't understand it. It was hidden from them and afraid to ask them about it. If we extend this out from the apostles to us, it makes sense that we're not all on the same page. Some of us still have things hidden from us. Some of us just can't understand it. And some of us are afraid to ask. Certainly the majority of the Jews were not permitted to understand Jesus and his mission because Jesus had to be rejected. We saw the reason for that last week. Look at chapter 9, verse 22. Saying the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day raised. This is not the first time Jesus told them, look, I'm going to go to die. They're not getting it. Now back to verse 45. But they did not understand this saying, and it was concealed from them. They didn't understand because they were prevented from understanding. Even the apostles were prevented from understanding. But what really strikes me about this verse is that they were afraid to ask Jesus for help in understanding. Why? By this time, they'd spent more than 3 years with Jesus. Why were they afraid to ask Jesus to explain? They'd asked Jesus to explain other things. They'd asked Jesus to explain, for example, the parable of the seeds, the sower and the seeds. Why this time were they afraid? I think, based on the way Luke has composed this narrative, I think it has to do with the transfiguration. Granted, only Peter, James, and John saw Jesus in his divinity, and they were told not to talk about it, but those were the guys that were the vocal leaders. Those were the guys that led the troop. Jesus in his divinity, in seeing Jesus in his divinity and then seeing Jesus cast out a demon that they could not, then hearing Jesus say he was going to die soon, they vapor locked. They couldn't understand. There was too much. Here's the creator, sustainer of the universe in his divinity in front of them saying, I'm going to die. How can you accept that? They just couldn't. And they refused to ask. Of course, we're clearly told they were prevented from understanding what Jesus said. Why would God do that? Because at the time it was not right for them to understand the truth about Jesus saying. Matthew records that Peter actually rebuked Jesus for saying he was going to die. No, you're not going to die. Peter doesn't understand the plan. Now, Peter got to hear Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus about the plan, but he didn't understand it. So he rebuked Jesus for saying he was going to die. John records that Jesus told them that what he was doing they wouldn't understand until later. That was on the night of the Last Supper when he's teaching them about communion and teaching them about what's coming, the sacrifice he's about to make. You're not going to understand it now, but there is a time coming when you will. They would become the foundation, part of the foundation of the church age, but not yet. Jesus still had to go through the cross. They also had to go through that cross experience. They had to, from afar, look up and see their Savior dead and spend Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday wondering what's next, only to find out he's raised from the dead. They had to go through that so they could understand. It was part of the process of their transformation, so they were ready to become the foundation of the church. But then Dr. Luke changes topic again. An argument arose among them as to which of them was the greatest. This is a proof text that they didn't get it yet. Because they are arguing who's the greatest in the kingdom. They weren't ready to be on Jesus' team yet. They were fighting about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom. They still didn't understand kingdom theology. They were still operating the way they operated in Israel, under their misguided understanding of the law. Israel was truly a hierarchical system. The chief priest was on the top of the heap. Then the other leaders, the 70 in the Sanhedrin, were the leaders. And then you had elders in every community. The varying levels of Pharisees, Sadducees, and scribes. Everyone knows their position, who is above and who is below them. They live on a ladder system. Everybody knows where you stand. So it makes sense for Peter and the boys to be arguing about who's at the top of the heap. Who's going to be the number one guy for Jesus on the top of the heap? That's the system that they knew. That's the system that they lived under. But in the coming kingdom, under kingdom theology, the system was going to be completely different. Look how Jesus answers them. But Jesus, knowing the reasoning of their hearts, took a child and put him by his side and said to them, whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you all is the one who is great. I love how Jesus uses practical illustrations. Jesus took one of the many kids running around and kind of sets him there so the apostles can see him. Focus on this little snot-nosed kid. Whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives me who sent, receives who sent me. For he who is least among you all is the one who is great. Who's greatest in the kingdom? The least of you. It's not about who will be in charge. But in accepting a small child who could not do any, a small child couldn't do anything for these guys. Except maybe schlep a pail of water or something. He couldn't really do anything for them. But if they'll accept him, they show they'll accept Jesus. And by accepting Jesus, they accept the Father. I don't think this speaks of salvation. This is not a salvific expression of, of accepting Jesus. I don't think that's what his intent here is at all. The context is that they rejected or didn't understand that Jesus had to die. So what's happening when Jesus at the top of the heap, in their group anyway, dies? He's no longer even in the heap. Jesus is telling them they need to get with the program that includes Jesus' death and resurrection, which is salvific. His death and resurrection is all about salvation. Then Jesus said, "For he who is least among you all is the one who is great." Diametrically opposed to the system Israel lived in and the system that we live in today. In Israel then, in America today, you prove your value for those above you by being the best, doing the most. For example, the guy that gets the $200 million contract in the NFL is not the guy that can't catch the ball or can't throw the ball or can't tackle somebody. The guy that only warms the bench, he doesn't get the $200 million contract. The guy that gets the $200 million contract is the guy that can catch the ball with one hand 12 feet in the air. That's the guy. He does, by the way, he's not coming this year from the Gators or the Noles. Just saying. You've got to prove yourself if you want to move up. You've got to be really good at what you do to move up. Or you work in the government and then they promote you to your level of incompetence. Just saying. Remember, Jesus is exposing kingdom theology, not prevailing practice. I suspect the apostles thought about what Jesus was saying. They had to spend a little bit of time ruminating on what Jesus was saying. You mean to be the number one guy, I've got to be like the least guy? Still not really getting it. But then John speaks up. "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he doesn't follow with us." See, they're still in their group. They're still in their tribe. John still didn't understand. I think he was looking for a way to endear himself to Jesus because he really didn't want to be least. I mean, who does, right? You know, if you're picking teams, you don't want to be the guy that's left. You want to be the guy picked first, not the picked last. So John says, "Well, boss, this guy came out casting out demons in your name, but he's not part of our group, so we disqualified him. He's not allowed to do that." The first question I have is, who does John mean when he says us? Does he mean the 12? Does he mean the 13 with Jesus? Who's he saying us? Here's what I think. I think he means only apostles. Remember that they just had to witness Jesus cast out a demon from a boy that they had previously tried to cast the demon out of. They failed. Then Jesus told them that their system of importance is upside down. I think John was using this as an occasion to say, well, apparently we've lost our power and authority, but this guy over here, who's not even part of our group, can do it. I guess we're the least in the kingdom. John's saying, hey, God, Jesus, this guy over here, he was casting out demons in your name, but he's not part of our group. We couldn't. We're nothing. Okay, we're at the bottom of the list, right? So now we're the top. You understand his rationale of what's going on in his brain? Clearly, John didn't understand what Jesus was saying. But we've already seen that the truth was hidden from them. But Jesus said to him, "Do not stop, for the one who is not against you is for you." Jesus responds to John's assertion by telling him to don't stop him. If he's not against you, he's for you. Now, there's also other problems with that, but in this context, it works. Jesus had just told him, again, that he was going to die soon. There was going to be many people against them. Don't force out those who are going in the same direction. If people are going in the same direction you are in serving Jesus, but they're in a different tribe, let them alone. Let them go. There's no reason to stop them. But there's another part of Jesus' response to John. Remember the immediate context, thinking about yourself as higher than you ought. I think John and the boys understood Jesus to tell them not to think they held exclusive authority and position in the kingdom. Sure, they were going to be part of the foundation, but they weren't everything in the kingdom. Remember, you got to be at the bottom of the list, not the top of the list. They would be part of the foundation. The church was going to be built by Jesus, not them. Climb down off the pedestal you've climbed yourself onto. And just do what Jesus tells you to do. This morning we saw Jesus cast out demons from a boy that the disciples couldn't. That was a frustration for the apostles, but it also amazed the people who were still not ready to see Jesus as the Messiah and God himself. Jesus told his disciples he was going to die soon, something that was difficult for them to accept. Jesus then taught more on kingdom theology than that we discovered the apostles weren't yet equipped to understand. It was hidden from them. Still a mystery, but it's hidden. Jesus told his apostles that the system they had all operated in was upside down. The hierarchical system of Judaism, the high priest and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, that's all upside down. And they would need to turn themselves upside down in order to work in the kingdom theology. Next week, Lord willing, as we finish chapter 9, as we see Jesus enter a Samaritan village, he's headed toward Jerusalem. He's going to what is known by him as certain fate. Let's focus on Jesus, on serving Jesus, and serving the people around us to be greatest in the kingdom. Let's make ourselves the least important by doing the most important. Father, thank you for the reality of what you've told us in your word. Thank you for the truth of your gospel. Thank you for the truth of kingdom theology. How through it we can learn who you are. We can learn what you want us to do. We can learn how you want us to do it. You've been very clear with us that we need to follow you and be obedient to you and do what you've told us, not what we think is right, what you've told us is right. You've given us some discernment so that we can make those decisions, but we do it based on what you've told us and not what makes us feel better, not what makes us look better. You've told us that's not what's important. What's important is being obedient, not being the star of the show. Thank you for loving us. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for watching or listening to this teaching on demand from Friendship Grace Brethren Church. Please consider sending us an email at info@friendshipgracebrethren.com to let us know how this teaching may have helped you. Please also consider joining us in person at Friendship Grace Brethren Church, located at 10251 Metro Parkway, Suite 116, Fort Myers, Florida, just south of the intersection of Metro and Colonial Boulevard. Sunday school begins at 9 and worship service at 10 a.m. We look forward to seeing you in person at Friendship Grace Brethren Church.